water is something that is in nature already. It has a cycle, but clearly it has been affected by the effects of the great climate change, which we are facing. And we are looking for a solution that actually allows us to protect this water for a longer time in the mountain range, to be able to deliver it downstream toward the communities.
The goal is to store some 100 million liters of water across 50 stupas next year. This would be enough water to supply 100,000 people for 3 months. The first prototype was erected in Park Arenas, an area known for its glaciers surrounding a volcano, the highest parts of the mountain region. Researchers and activists have warned that glaciers in the Andes Mountains have been receding in recent years. They blame climate change for the loss of glaciers and water shortages.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Despite overwhelming evidence that most of the world's fossil fuel reserves must stay in ground, governments are still approving new projects. The British government has 40 fossil fuel projects in the pipeline, despite being the host of COP26. Australia, too, continues to approve new gas and coal developments. We now present you an article written by Jeremy Moss, Professor of Political Philosophy at the University of New South Wales in Australia. The piece is titled COP26 Leaves Too Many Loopholes for Fossil Fuel Industry. For the Glasgow Climate Summit to be judged a success, a key outcome had to be that parties agree the majority of the world's fossil fuel reserves need to be left in the ground. As recent research suggests, 89% of coal and 59% of gas reserves need to stay in the ground if there's to be even a 50% chance of global temperature rise staying under the crucial limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius this century. The summit, COP26, has not lived up to that ambition because there are too many loopholes for the fossil fuel industry to exploit. Some promising proposals have been put forward, including the pledge to cut methane emissions, some increased emissions reductions targets at the national level, limits to deforestation, and ending some overseas funding of fossil fuels. On Thursday, 11th of November, 13 countries launched a new alliance to end gas and oil production within their borders, led by Denmark and Costa Rica. But most proposals suffer either from a lack of ambition or a lack of participation from key countries. Take the pledge to cut methane emissions. Some of the biggest methane emitters, such as Australia, failed to sign up to the agreement. Similarly, the plan to phase out coal allows some signatories, such as Indonesia, to keep building coal-fired power plants. What these proposals, and indeed the whole COP process, suffer from is an inability to address the fact that if we're to avoid the worst of climate change, we simply can't keep extracting fossil fuels. While national governments and their negotiators remain willing to listen to the interests of fossil fuel lobbyists, the COP process will continue to be riddled with all sorts of loopholes that will derail the achievement of real targets. Five big loopholes come to mind. Much has been made of the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, a global coalition of financial institutions that aims to accelerate the decarbonisation of the economy. But many of its efforts will be undermined while governments continue to subsidise the fossil fuel industry, with fossil fuel subsidies globally running at $11 million every minute. The Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero is insufficient to halt emissions because subsidizing the cost of production and sale of fossil fuels continues to make the industry feasible. Moreover, the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero is voluntary when we need commitments to be binding. It also includes banks that have recently provided $575 billion in fossil fuel finance to some of the world's biggest polluters. Governments should not wait for future COPs to address this issue. Countries should immediately start reining in the subsidies that make the fossil fuel industry profitable and should not entertain new subsidies. Despite the overwhelming evidence that most of the world's fossil fuel reserves must stay in the ground, governments are still approving new projects. The British government has 40 fossil fuel projects in the pipeline, despite being host of the COP26 summit. Australia too continues to approve new gas and coal developments. The New South Wales government has approved 8 new projects since 2018, despite the state's target of 50% emissions reduction by 2030. Until future climate negotiations put a ban on new fossil fuel projects and agree to a clear and rapid phase-out of current production levels, the fossil fuel industry will continue to thrive. A further loophole for the fossil fuel industry is how it's being allowed to continue its huge levels of production because it has committed, in some cases, to making its operations greener. Measures such as carbon capture and storage and offsetting have been touted by some governments as solutions to bringing the industry's emissions down. But these are not real solutions if they simply allow fossil fuel production and use to continue at dangerous levels. While offsetting will have to play a role in reducing emissions in some hard-to-abate sectors such as aviation and agriculture, it is not a substitute for genuine cuts to fossil fuel use, and misleadingly gives the impression fossil fuel companies are going green. Of course, these loopholes that allow fossil fuel production are no accident. The largest group of representatives at COP26 were from the fossil fuel industry. One of the striking and disturbing characteristics of government approaches to climate change is the impact of fossil fuel companies on decision-making. It's hard to think of other issues, smoking, peace negotiations, where we tolerate this kind of influence. The industry's influence on successive Australian governments has been well documented, with more than $136.8 million Australian dollars, that is equivalent to $100 million American dollars, in donations recorded between 1999 and 2019. Having a display by gas company Santos, a major donor to Australian political parties, at Australia's COP26 pavilion in Glasgow rightly provoked ridicule. The failure to address these loopholes will mean the production of fossil fuels will continue for much longer than it should. The fact there are still willing buyers for fossil fuel assets, such as BHP's Queensland coal mines, indicates investors are anticipating years of profits ahead and few climate liabilities from fossil fuels, despite the measures proposed at COP26 in Glasgow. One of the most glaring failures of COP26 is the failure to connect emission cuts with production cuts. Nowhere is this more apparent than in countries such as Norway, which has impressive domestic reduction targets, 55% by 2030, yet continues to champion fossil fuel production through oil and gas exploration. A key to progress at future COPs and domestically is ending the false idea that one can make progress on climate by cutting domestic emissions, while simultaneously supporting fossil fuel production. If countries such as Australia and Norway can't come together to agree on cutting support for production, then we will continue to see loopholes that allow the industry to flourish. Some countries are taking positive steps. The Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, that aims to phase out production, is key to cutting supply of fossil fuels. Multilateral action such as this, whether as part of COP or outside of it, and crucially, the pressure from below that causes it, must be a focus if we're to avoid climate change. No mosque in Seville.
The water erupts and flows through the Alcázar Garden, part of Seville, Spain, in which the royal household is located. This place is also considered the official area of the central government. More than 10 centuries ago, Muslims ruled over this land. Abdulrahman III, Caliph of Córdoba, ordered the construction of these buildings. That was when the historical triangle of big Islamic capitals of Andalus, Córdoba, Granada came into being. Gradually, Alcázar became the center of cultural life in the city. Alcázar is also a prime example of architecture that shows the elegance of a civilization, which is still an immeasurable part of the Al-Andalus identity. This majestic example of architecture, even after being recaptured by the Christians, retained its elegance and was developed by Muslim architects once again. Outside these walls, Giralda can be seen. The mosque's minaret is adjacent to the Alcázar Castle. This minaret, which is currently being used as the Catholic Church steeple, became the international symbol of Seville City. This is one of the famous historical landmarks in the capital city, Al-Andalus.
Historically, people, academia, and politicians have always noticed the importance of the Islamic Seville in its own era. Seville played an important role, both in the time of war and peace. Even today, the name of Seville can be found in political books. There are also other proven facts, such as immigrants that can be seen in the streets or working in institutions in the city of Seville.
Every day, thousands of tourists, mostly Muslims from every corner of the globe, visit their historical heritage. They can't help thinking about the past, the time when things were better for Muslims. This statement holds true for this neighborhood and the ones on the outskirts of Seville, where many Muslim immigrants, mostly Moroccan, reside. This neighborhood has been devastated by economic strife, unemployment, and a lack of social resources. The basement of this building, which isn't easily noticed, is one of the six mosques in the town. Perhaps it is better to describe it as something more like a hall for the Muslim community to perform their religious rituals in. This place is located among the malls and business centers that used to thrive in the past.
Assalamu alaikum, yo soy Jihad.
Hi, I'm Jihad Sarasua from Seville, Al-Andalus. I'm a Muslim. We are in Ishbilia Mosque that we built in the Maid's neighborhood, so Muslims could perform their rituals. This is one of the popular neighborhoods of Seville, where many of us are living together. This mosque was built to meet today's needs of the Muslim community. This is all we have in this neighborhood. This neighborhood belongs to the working class, so this place is okay considering the fact that there is no business or social centers here. We have to, as Muslims, build up a community in such a poor condition. But we need a place where Muslims of Seville can get together to display the true image of Muslim communities, right? Yes, of course, we need that. We are working hard to get what we want. We need a proper neighborhood to show the splendid image of Islam in Seville.
Probably asking the municipality on behalf of the Muslim community of the city would make them grant us a loan. We could use it for Bujeira Mosque, located in Mila de Oro, Seville. We also have historical background in our favor. The constructions will be close to the Alcázar Castle, one of the greatest preserved treasures from the caliphates. There we meet Javier Fito, one of the residents of Seville, who is defending his Muslim community's right to a place where they can perform their rituals and congregations.
As far as I know, most of the mosques are in the basements of buildings. Sometimes these places get really crowded and there is also a lack of space and standard conditions. In the best case scenario, we can only have access to emergency exits. We don't even have the basic conditions here. Trying to have the right place is what we can do to make this situation better. Mosques are supposed to be social centers and community spaces, just like Catholic churches or any other social centers. We should have a better place for public use. What we have right now is still far away from what we have in mind. These places are really cramped. These buildings are not designed for religious purposes. Therefore, problems like poor standards of hygiene arise.
This is what the Muslim community has been struggling against for 25 years. These struggles started when some people in Seville who had converted to Islam openly asked for a proper mosque. While other religious communities had a better situation, they continued to struggle because they had to gather in unsuitable places to pray together.
There are some lecture halls for praying in the basements, lower floors or on the outskirts of Seville. There is no congregational mosque in Seville in spite of efforts to have one.
The idea of building this mosque became a contentious issue in the 90s. At that time, I was a member of the city council and I held the position until 2003. It all started when the Muslim community went to the municipality to get them convinced to have a congregational mosque. Well, personally, I believe that almost everyone in the municipality and political parties there liked the idea, because the idea had a sense of mutual respect and religious freedom. It's quite natural, isn't it? So, different religions can have their own place to perform their rituals. There could also be some other aspects in addition to having a mosque. At the beginning, it seemed that there was no problem with it. There were talks about renting a place for that purpose in Seville, somewhere that had traces of Islamic traditions. Everything passed so quickly and there was no result. They noticed it would be problematic to convert an old church into a mosque in the center of the city. They wanted more than that. It was more affordable to have it built in a new neighborhood. That was when they looked at Bermejal as an option, right?
This is the mosque in Seville. The only accepted and known mosque in the city that we can talk about as a mosque without any inhibitions is this one. Especially when the famous footballer Frederick Canute bought this place and gave it to Al-Ikhwan Al-Muslimun, who, after some failed attempts to build a mosque, took the initiative and managed this place.
Tomado ese relevo por nosotros, lo cual, el cual
we gathered at Al-Andalus Parliament to talk it out with MPs and PSOE. Then we asked for the place, just like what other religious communities had, a place with good conditions and enough space for public use. Then we officially registered our request, and after 2 months we got our answer. We had an agreement to allot a place to the Muslim community. It was out of the city with no other buildings around, and we had no other way but to accept it. After a while, we noticed it wouldn't be that bad in the distant future. We accepted it, and we did the paperwork, and we even got the deeds and documents.
Now they had started working on the construction of this mosque on the land which belonged to the Muslim community. The responsibility was given to this young architect from Seville, and they started the project with a predetermined fund of more than 3 million euros. This mosque was supposed to be one of the biggest mosques in Europe, a building of 3,000 square meters, two floors, a capacity of more than 2,000 people, a public yard and a private parking lot. A mosque which would finally give the Muslims of this city a place to congregate. And of course, the rest of the people of Seville would be able to enjoy the modern atmosphere of the place in which followers of different religions and schools of thought could gather to swap ideas and information.
El volumen principal, como no puede ser otra forma, es la nave que hace de oratorio.
The original structure was a ship of two floors with a dome covered by green tiles. Undoubtedly, genders are separated in accordance with the Islamic law. So the first floor would be used by men and the second floor by women. In the center, we have two hollow places leading to the dome. And in the front, we have the Qibla with a somewhat upward slope to show a symbolic feature which can only be seen in a mosque. Around the main yard, we would have different services, Some of them were considered for public use and some of them more private, such as a halal restaurant, a cafeteria, a library, and a place for other cultural activities, originally designed to be used as a cultural environment for public use.
Now that we had the land, the project was presented, accepted, and funded to start. Everything was ready to end 10 years of marginalization. It was almost impossible for the growing number of Muslims in Seville to dream of a mosque, but then everything went wrong.
Soon, a rumor went around that a mosque was going to be built, something that wasn't easy to hide. It didn't seem bad or something that neighbors wouldn't like. The idea of building a mosque wasn't against the society or any other religious sects. Well, it's hard to find an old church in the city center district. It's obvious that we can't find a space in the city center. That's why the idea of building new neighborhoods came up. Normally, in an old neighborhood, the government had already monopolized the lands and any other construction activities. Everything was running smoothly until the neighbors found out about the mosque and they reacted badly against it.
Las personas del barrio en que se iba a plantear la.
The neighborhood was biased against building a mosque. Biased, yes. Most of these immigrants from the West are economically down. And in most cases, they cannot even meet their basic needs. It's not right to think of keeping the poor and the immigrants away from yourself. We shouldn't forget, not too long ago, we had the same situation when we had to emigrate to France or Germany. I think all we needed was a smile and more support instead of xenophobia.
This is Conchita Rivas. She has been the chief of the Bermejales neighborhood since it was established. She is one of the public figures against the construction of the mosque. They claim they have no intention of insulting the Muslim community. They simply prefer a medical clinic to a mosque. Today, they are passing by an abandoned land with no mosque or any other construction in the public interest.
At the beginning, it was mentioned in the press that Muslims want to build the biggest mosque in Europe. We went to the municipality for some explanations, and they said that it had already been planned and there was nothing we could do about it. I told them that Bermejales community had also a part in making decisions. We'd had other important plans on the agenda and they hadn't been actualized yet. This is why we disagreed. However, we held a referendum in Paseo de Europa Park to decide the issue. In addition, on our left side, we had a related opinion box for saying yes or no to the mosque. There wasn't even one ballot paper in the ballot box.
A partir de ese momento en el que se hace esa asamblea informativa,
then we received information indicating that anything bad could happen. We tried the idea two times and they opposed us each time. We tried to sort things out. We talked to them and we talked to the press to tell them they had no right to treat us like animals. Behind all this, there were also children at the school to whom the idea of xenophobia was indoctrinated by the neighbors. This issue was spreading nationwide. On the internet, we could see anti-mosque posts on websites from across Spain, Valencia, Madrid. We received emails and messages that had no indication of the term coexistence.
mensajes y correos y que no tenían nada que ver con lo que significa la convivencia.
These documents and newspaper pieces are about the mosque project lawsuit, the project begun by the Muslim community. It was interesting to see the unusual presence of the National Intelligence Center at different stages of the whole issue, and both sides of the struggle mentioned this.
I met with two officials in the National Intelligence Center. These people were trying to convince me that I had to forget about the whole thing. But I had my goals. I have always fought against injustice, ignorance, and whatever I'd find insulting. I told them that I wasn't going to give up.
Nuestras relaciones con las con los organismos de información del Estado son directas.
We were in direct contact with the CNI itself and the CNI police. In every aspect, we were frank and direct. We had nothing to hide from the society.
After a long lawsuit, the Supreme Court voted in favor of the neighbors, and the municipality was criticized for poor decision-making. Now, the municipality was trying to find a new place for the mosque. The new place was on Kartuha Island, where international exhibitions used to be held in 1992, a combination of abandoned, transferred, and constructed lands for educational and business purposes. The entrepreneurial community of Seville was the last to oppose the construction of the mosque. We chose three places: a church, a piece of land for public use in a newly built neighborhood, and a piece of land in an area for public services. Three projects, three hopes, three failures. But the Muslims did not give up. They chose another piece of land to buy in a neighborhood of San Jeromino. Once again, the neighbors took to the streets and the same scenes took place. Even some extremists buried a pig in the land chosen for the construction to make fun of Islamic law, which asserts pigs are unclean. The truth is that they wanted to stop them from building the mosque, no matter what. Finally, the whole project came to a halt.
I believe that this issue, apart from being politically motivated, was a problem of coexistence. And also another crucial factor can be the lack of understanding a civilization or a certain way of thinking. I think all these contributing factors sapped the mosque project. Personally, I truly believe that Muslims in Seville deserve a proper mosque.
It's hard to believe that a city like Seville, which was ruled by Muslims for more than 5 or 6 centuries with its Islamic background, has no place for Muslims to perform their rituals. Most of the neighborhoods oppose the idea of constructing a mosque, although more important issues can be found in these neighborhoods. We are in San Jeronimo, La Macarena. Since the time of economic crisis, this part of the city has been hit by depression. These people are losing everything. Yet, they demonstrate not against these crises, not against unemployment or their violated rights, but against their neighbors who want to build a place to do their rituals, simply because they don't understand the metaphysical values behind it. These people have no reason to stop the Muslims to build a mosque.
Whoever wants to be the Seville mayor has to know that the city needs a place to represent the Muslim community. Honestly, according to our constitution, our city deserves such a place. We will try to find another way, with the help of the private sector, to get this project done, and we hope to make it happen in the years to come. An unofficial census estimates the population of the Muslim community to be around 10,000, representing at least 20 different nations. Most of them were converted Spaniards, Moroccans, and others from southern parts of Africa.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Prices of everyday items in the U.S. have surged during the pandemic, thanks to a toxic combination of staffing shortages and supply chain woes. The rising prices are souring the national mood and taking a political toll on President Biden. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of NPR website. This article is titled, U.S. Inflation is Surging and People Are Hopping Mad. Stay tuned for more. Prices of everyday items in the U.S. have surged during the pandemic, thanks to a toxic combination of staffing shortages and supply chain woes. The rising prices are souring the national mood and taking a political toll on President Biden. Grocery prices in October were 5.4% higher than a year ago, according to the latest Consumer Price Index. Overall inflation was 6.2%, the highest annual figure in more than three decades. High inflation poses a particular challenge for people on fixed incomes, like Rink, a retiree in Washington, D.C. She relies on Social Security and her monthly benefit of $1,578 doesn't stretch as far as it used to. According to the U.S. government's tally, chicken prices in October were 8.8% higher than a year ago. Beef prices have climbed even more. Energy prices are among the biggest drivers of inflation. Rink is paying almost 50% more for gasoline now than she did a year ago, and 28% more for the natural gas that she uses to heat her house. Winter bills are likely to be even higher for those who rely on heating oil, like Nick Apodikos, who shares a house in Boston with his 94-year-old mother. For my mom, even if it's 100 degrees out, she still is cold. He says, now it's going to be more cold. Heating oil prices have soared 59% in the last year. Nick's mom, Rose Apodius, also relies on Social Security. Like others on the program, her benefits will increase in January by 5.9%. That's the biggest cost of living increase that the U.S. government has granted in four decades, but it has already been eclipsed by inflation. Nick says, before you'd go to the store, and if you had $100, you could buy four bags of groceries and be happy. Now, you're lucky to get a bag, milk, orange, juice, eggs, plus the oil for the house, the water bills. It's just crazy. It's so much money. How is somebody supposed to survive? Both the White House and the Federal Reserve have described this inflationary spike as a temporary byproduct of the pandemic, which has snarled supply chains and kept a lot of people out of work. Like the pandemic, though, price hikes don't appear to be going away anytime soon. I think we're going to see inflation get worse before it gets better, says Sarah House, an economist with Wells Fargo. Inflation is no longer confined to a few pandemic-plagued categories such as lumber or used cars. Upward pressure on prices is spreading throughout the economy. There is nowhere for consumers to hide, House says. It suggests inflation is going to be stickier. Airfares were down in October, but they're likely to take off again as travel picks up. Rents are rising too. While wages are climbing, especially in industries like restaurants, many businesses are passing those added labor costs out to the consumers in the form of higher prices. All of this is weighing on Americans' attitudes. A survey by the University of Michigan released recently shows people are as gloomy about the economy as they have been in a decade. One out of four people said their living standards had fallen this month because of inflation. That presents a serious political liability for Biden, whose approval ratings on the economy have fallen below 40%. Biden acknowledges the hardship that higher prices are causing. Everything from a gallon of gas to a loaf of bread costs more, he told the crowd in Baltimore. And it's worrisome even though wages are going up. Biden said in a statement that reversing inflation is a top priority for him, but many voters won't be satisfied until prices start to level off. Nick Apodikas wonders why the Biden administration isn't doing more, even if the White House's options are limited. He says, I think that the White House is not focused as much on the things that the people need. I understand that climate change is an important thing, he says, nodding to another administration priority. Focus on climate change, but also focus on price change, he said.
Simple question.
There's trouble in London's police service at New Scotland Yard. They state our vision for the Met is to be the most trusted police service in the world. We contribute to making London the safest global city. We protect its unique reputation as an open and welcoming city. And we want Londoners to be proud of their police. However, a series of damaging cases involving people who have served as London police officers may have undermined the credibility of the Met's ability to sustain the confidence and trust of the general public.
In late 2021, two UK police officers pleaded guilty to sharing photos of the bodies of two murdered sisters at a crime scene they were assigned to protect. In court, officers Dennis Jaffa and Jamie Lewis admitted sharing the images.
Are you going to apologise for what you did?
Today they admitted misconduct.
Other officers. officers have been accused of abandoning an alleged domestic abuse victim in a flat shared with her potentially violent partner, with police allegedly telling her, "There is nothing we can do." Worse still, former police officer Wayne Cousins was convicted of abducting Sarah Everard in a London street as she walked home, then raping and murdering her in a case that has shocked Britain. Her body was found in woodland 80 kilometres away in southeast England. The Everard case has stirred protests over violence against women by the police. The impact of these convictions involving officers has been felt inside and outside the police service. The Metropolitan Police Force, which investigated the murder by Cousins, said it was sickened, angered and devastated by his crimes. Commissioner Cressida Dick apologised, while Labour Party politician Harriet Harman called on Dick to resign, adding, "Women must be able to trust the police, not fear them. Women's confidence in police will have been shattered." Even Prime Minister Boris Johnson added, "Our police are there to protect us, and I know that officers will share in our shock and devastation at the total betrayal of this duty."
How can people who have committed criminal acts of violence pass the recruitment process for a police force? What impact have recent convictions of police officers in London for serious law-breaking offences had on public confidence in the law enforcement services? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What, in terms of the public's view, constitutes a reasonable standard of behaviour for police officers? We put that to the public here in central London. This is what they told us.
Generally, what do you expect in terms of standards of behaviour from any police force? What do you want the police, how do you want them to behave?
I want them to be supportive, but not like judge people based on obviously looks or gender or anything like that. I don't want them to be scary. I don't want to be like they're facing towards me and I become scared of them.
Well, one would hope for high standards, but just lately, probably not.
At least 50% better than they are at the moment.
Yes.
But they have a hard time. They've got so many things that they're controlled to do, like racial things, abuse of people.
Just to meet the basic, like the citizen needs, like if they need any help with directions, or if you see that they're like in trouble, just to assist, just to help out. If you see someone stealing, but they're stealing like diapers type of thing, then just like help out, I guess. That's a policeman's job anywhere around the world, I feel like.
Yes.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
You know, not behave in the way that we've seen recently in the news, in terms of we want to be able to trust them.
Yes.
And feel that we're in safe hands.
Yes.
So there needs to be a very strong code of conduct, and if people don't follow that code of conduct, then they need to go. The job's not right for them.
Just like security, like if you ever like, you know, if something ever happened, that you could phone them and they would be there quite quickly.
For them to treat everyone equally, not to treat people different, look different than others. I would expect them to be polite to the public, to look. I think you want to see a police officer and feel that they're safe to approach, and you know.
I think throughout COVID, it's probably changed a little bit. Less aggressive, to be honest, what I've seen on the news. I know they've got a hard job to do, but I think on the news lately they haven't been portrayed very well.
And the tourists, they don't know particularly about the people that they can take away their bags or their phones, like me, that I hand my phone. So I expect to protect those people and like to do not leave it like this, like, okay, just leave it happen. It's something that can happen every day.
Just good discipline, really, around, obviously, a lot of presence.
I think just being available for the public when they need them.
Well, I expect them to be respectful and to consider the needs of the people that they're protecting.
I think they should be courteous.
They should be there and available for you to speak to.
Two police officers admitted sharing photos of two murdered women in London on a social network. How does the public feel about their actions?
Yeah, that's a different kind of situation there, too, obviously. I mean, as you say, when you're a police officer, you obviously want your 100% pride themselves, you trust them, don't you, really? And stuff like that, as obviously, yeah, there's no excuse, there's no for that, is there, really? You can't excuse that at all.
I think it's horrendous, and what's probably worse is they shared it and other people looked at them and presumably quite enjoyed them, and it's awful.
I think they should get fired. That's definitely confidential, so they shouldn't be sharing that. Yeah.
That's disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. Now, I work for the NHS and we see some difficult things at work, and it's gross misconduct if you share any information about your patients or any images, and I would expect the police to behave in exactly the same way. And to have a WhatsApp group, it's just terrible.
You wouldn't expect that from police officers. They're meant to be there to keep you safe, so that just really angers me whenever I hear that. Yeah.
First I've heard of it, but it obviously sounds wrong.
Yeah.
But I mean, you just inherently think that's wrong just as a person, not a policeman or otherwise. Just as a human, you wouldn't do that, would you?
At the scene of a crime, that's terrible. I don't think any private thing should be taken or shared. It's police material, should not be shared with the public.
I think that's very, very, very bad and very unrespectful towards the woman, but also the family towards this woman.
I think that's definitely sort of part over the line as such. Definitely not professional and shouldn't happen, really.
I don't know the details of that particular incident, but if that was done without consideration of their privacy or was not part of some kind of formal release of investigation, then I think there's probably some wrongdoing there.
I think it's a boundary that has been crossed. I don't think that that's the right thing to do.
Just not having any clue of the feelings of the families or all people. You're dealing with this traumatic event and you just don't have the compassion to understand how traumatic this is for everyone. If you're taking photos and being a tourist about it, we're kind of losing the point of being a person.
Social media is probably 90% of the problem, and I think anybody that uses that platform to accentuate any crime or reveal and share is rather disturbed, to be honest.
A London police officer has been jailed for life for raping and murdering a woman called Sarah Everard. How is it that a murderer was able to serve in the police? Here's the public's opinion.
Perhaps, there needs to be tightened regulations or a reevaluation of how, we select the police. Or
they should obviously have to go up against a platform of where there's some kind of control or procedure that's put in place, like it was in the old days in the United Kingdom.
I guess you never know who the bad guy is until something happens.
It got through the loophole somehow because I presume they do checks. Some things weren't picked up, so something's gone wrong there. I mean, there are bad people in all walks of society.
Maybe they just didn't do enough background checks on him before he went into the police force. Maybe they need to get more, tighter on security checks on who's going into the police.
How would anyone know that someone is going to do that, right? And you can only run a criminal background check on someone if they've been convicted of a crime. So if they've been suspected and weren't indicted on it, weren't convicted of it, then there's no record of it.
I wonder the same thing. But then also rapists and murderers are also a bit everywhere. It's just sad that they're all in the police force because you think, if I want to be police, I'm a good person and should follow the law. And also leads to more, scariness because why should I trust the police if they also murder me? And like that.
How do they? I wouldn't be best to answer that. I'm sure they get vetted before they start the role, but it's not nice. But it could happen in any profession, I suppose. But yeah, again, it's you'd expect it not to happen in the police, but these things do happen, unfortunately.
Well, there's obviously a lot of police personnel, so anyone can get in, really. again, it's down to the individual. I wouldn't say that's them as a whole, and to say it is them as a whole is completely wrong, in my opinion.
It's a very sad news, and I think it puts the entire police on a very bad spot.
Well, I don't think, say, mental illness or those type of issues, they have no bounds. It doesn't matter what your career is or how intelligent you are.
I should think the vetting process needs to be more studied and more thorough when they either at recruiting stage or progressively through their life.
Here are the facts. The London Metropolitan Police employs almost 33,000 officers in the front line to try and keep law and order in a city with a population of around 10 million people. Yet, since 2005, 26 Met officers were convicted of sex crimes, 27 of theft, and 72 were convicted of violence against other people. Has public confidence been affected by these latest convictions? A poll in October 2021 revealed 63% of those polled trusted the police in general, but only 33% trusted the Metropolitan Police. In the same poll, 31% said they did not trust the police in general, but that lack of trust rises to 43% for the London Metropolitan Police, meaning that more people distrust the London Met than trust them.
Given all these recent revelations, what level of trust do the people here in London feel able to give their police force?
That's a loaded question.
would you make a call and feel safe? Or?
I would make a call, yeah. I mean, because at the end of the day, you still have to trust that the government is working.
You would go to them, but not perhaps one on his own.
Yes.
You'd want two.
Difficult to say, because I think the Londoners have come to accept it. Visitors, depending on where they come from, might find it strange to have that sort of police force in somewhere like civilised world like the UK.
I think anywhere in the world that stuff happens. Like, the police and the government's corrupt anywhere.
It's an isolated incident, and I would say 99.9% of police officers are doing the job for the right reason. You can't tar them all with the same brush.
I do still trust the police because that was one person, but yeah, it's just, it makes it quite difficult, you know, to trust them after hearing that.
How many policemen are there in London, policemen or women? I'd say this is a very, very small minority, surely, of the force as a whole, in which case I'd be likely to trust them.
Not really so much trust, because like when I see them or like when they're around the area, I want to feel like, okay, safe, they're here. But if I know that they also do this and that it happens often, of course I don't feel safe around them.
To be honest, not very much. Unfortunately, I have here 2 years, and to be honest, I don't have seen much effort from the police to do their best to protect their people, the residents here.
Just because, you know, that's what you see in the news and the paper, so that's the sort of front face of the police is the negative stuff. I do think the police do a lot of positive as well that doesn't necessarily get reported on.
Well, the fact that if it's been confirmed that someone like that has been serving in our police, and it, particularly if it's been known for a while and action hasn't been taken, then it reduces our trust.
There's a lot of crime in the police force happening, so I think it's hard to say 100% yes.
Well, I guess you do somewhat not. It does reduce your trust.
You know, you have these kind of incidents all over the world, and I don't think London policing or the police force in the United Kingdom should be held to blame for an incident like that.
Well, that's not fair to lump all the police together, so I think there's still trust in the London police.
Looking at the situation from an international perspective, what image does this police behaviour generate to the wider world about the way law and order is carried out in the capital of the United Kingdom?
I guess you just got to be